This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Toni Marosevich. She's the author of a book of nonfiction stories called Pink Harvest, and she is also the author of three collections of poetry: My Oblique Strategies, Thorngate Road Press, and the winner of the Frank O'Hara Chapbook Award; Queer Street, published by Custom Words; and The Rooms We Make Our Own, Firebrand Books. Now she has a fourth book of poems out called The Takeaway Bin. Welcome, Toni Marosevich.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
The poems in this book are all based on a card game called Oblique Strategies. Well, would you explain that game to us?
Well, it's a card game that was created by Brian Eno and Peter Schmidt, I believe in 1975. And it was created to deal with working dilemmas that might come up, that you might have, any kind of creative dilemma or working dilemma, so that on over 100 cards, there's a little piece of advice or a strategy to deal with whatever you have facing you. Let's say you wake up, you have a daily dilemma. What am I going to do today? Well, you can pick a card from the deck of 100 cards, and it might say, honor thy error as hidden intention. And you might take that and then just start to riff on that or start to apply that to whatever dilemma you have. And how I got the deck was my partner of many years gave me, she sent away to England and got an original deck from 1975. So it's a very valuable deck at this point. And how I started to use it with this particular project was that I would pick a card and then start to riff in terms of writing off of that strategy, and that's how the poems would result.
There's a website where anyone can go and get text from this game. You might want to Google for it instead. You click on a link each time you'd like new text. When I clicked on it a few times, I got the following: don't stress one thing more than another. The next one I got was abandon normal instruments. And finally, do we need holes?
You know, one of the things that is a joy with using the cards is really having them in the palm of your hand. So, and I've used them in creative writing classes. I've had students pick a card, and there's something about that little white square with the strategy printed on it. And it really has something about having that in the palm of the hand gets you going in a way that is different than looking at a computer screen. So I'm sure that one could use the computer with oblique strategies, but this is, there's something lovely about picking this strategy as if you're picking advice from someone else. And so you have a hand in selecting the advice, and you're holding the physical item, and then a little bit different than the tech way.
Well, let's stop talking about oblique strategies for a minute. And would you just like to go ahead and read some poems?
You know, I'd love to. And I'll start out with, let's start out with Woulda, Coulda, Shoulda. And the strategy that I selected that started this poem was, how would you have done it? Woulda, coulda, shoulda. The strategy, how would you have done it? With less panache, with the pedal to the metal, with a holy roller, with her by my side, with a canopy billowing, with a nutcracker. You're a ball breaker, my boss said without irony. Without irony in her comely stepsister chastity. Chaz Bono had plastic surgery, and I hear he's eating with alacrity again. They shared a submarine sandwich. With a torpedo, with my second strike capabilities, with her by my side, in a sidecar, yelling at the sideswipe who sideswiped us. With new windshield wipers for a better view of the playing field. With cantilevers, with torque, with the yoga instructor's instructions. Breathe in. Say to yourself, let. Breathe out. Say to yourself, go. With a blacksmith, a white knight, a black and tan, with a tam o'shanter. The driver of the shuttle van wore a plaid cap, a tartan skirt. She spoke with a heavy brogue and called her vehicle the van o'shanter. Drive the point home. Drive, said the other passengers. Drive, I said, with her by my side. Swipe the bugs off your grill. Smile into the billowing breeze. I woulda, coulda, shoulda done it differently if I'd had the balls to let go. The poem Judge Not had the strategy, ask people to work against their better judgment. Judge Not. Recalcitrant as we are, some good may come of it. Maybe roses in winter, maids in pink, coffers may unfill and spill on the heads of the more fortunate. Every ill thought will take a U-turn and smite the forehead of the ill-tempered, branding them for a day or two. It's slavish work, but someone has to do it. Asking doesn't mean getting the most desired response. There could be a package in the mailbox, torn, rent, and tampered with. Don't we all want to take a peek inside and view the contents? Later we can apologize with glass beads and drink Manhattans. The days of wine and peonies doesn't quite have the same ring. Judge as ye shall judge, but most of us fudge when it comes to doing the right thing. We slip up this side of the Mississippi, fall short, and that's the long of it. If we were full of integrity, there'd be no room for a night at the Motel 6 with a six-pack. One friend worked out, worked against her better judgment, and developed a 12-pack. Now that was a rack to carry. If you slack off, maybe the best judgment is the result. Let's not try so hard to look so good. I know you slipped the guy a Mickey. You know I double-dipped. The collection plate was a little light in the loafers as we boozed in the pews. Let the self-righteous tally up. One of my favorite poems is entitled The Worst, and the strategy that I selected from the box was give way to your worst impulse. Our worst impulse has yet to be discovered. There's the usual cavalcade of stars, sloth, trickery, the catty comment which only yields a surface wound. Go instead for the jugular, juggle your options like oranges, give the right-of-way to the cad, the ne'er-do-well, the climber. Stop saving pennies for the dower. What would happen if you let your scout membership lapse? As a still unfurled campfire girl, I tried to collect beads for good deeds, but only ended up with a choker. Fashionable, but tight. The scout master's daughter had strands and strands, a heavy necklace to trip over, a jump rope. I wanted to spike her milk, and my impulse cost me 3 beads, not enough to wring the neck of a ring-necked pheasant. One impulse gave way to another, but the bluebird bylaws stopped me from carrying out my crime. Whereas, I notice, an afterthought, the instruction was to give way to your impulse, not mine. And who knows, your worst may be my best, or vice versa.
Maybe you can talk about the title, the takeaway, Ben, what this refers to, and the process of writing the poems that ended up in this book.
You know how all of the poems start? They start with the strategy, but the title of the book is The Takeaway Bin. And my feeling is that our minds are takeaway bins, and that what we have there is something akin to all of the things you throw in one of those old drawers in your house where you toss things that you can't throw away. And, you know, old batteries, and there's some coins, and there's some little piece of paper with the secret to your life that you've written on it there, and that's tossed in there too. And so the poems take the strategy, and that's the starting point, but then the process is really going through the substrata of the mind and what's left in the takeaway bin. Like you can have certainly cliche, you can have musical riffs, you can have movie tunes, you can have memory. All of those things are just continue to circle. And as the poem develops, it's almost as if going through the substrata of that takeaway drawer, takeaway bin, and then things start to link up in a way that certainly wasn't planned. My other books of poems and nonfiction are more sight and subject specific, and more narrative. And this is more of an internal journey.
You have a prose poem in here called Elaborate, and I'm curious to know where that particular poem came from.
The poem Elaborate, when I think back on it now, I think what often the poems are not only triggered by the strategy, but they are triggered by what's happening in the political, social, current world of events when I was writing the piece. So I believe there was a great deal of discussion about, and now I'm forgetting, a great deal of discussion about creationism in the school. And this was a little bit of a way to slap back at that. So the poem Elaborate, the strategy is always first steps. It was oh so simple at first. Who begat whom? Who started it all? But somehow a slight infraction became an infarction. We turned one cheek, then the other, and soon we were spinning, face forward, then butt ugly. It's a vertiginous life, said the prophet, a guy who'd lost his footing more than once. Before we could stand upright, someone stepped on our knuckles, shove came to shove, and we went ape over the debate, creationism versus crustaceanism. You say you want an evolution? Well, we all want to change the world. He was a cretin, Eve said, after her first date with destiny, a fumbler, a stumblebum. Whatever happened to the sure-footed approach? If I say it all began with plankton, you're sure to argue something smells fishy, and that's when the story starts to get elaborate.
So it should be pretty obvious to our listeners now that the book is full of wordplay, all kinds. Some based on sound. You have morals with questionable morals in your poem qualifying round. Let sleeping dogs lie, not as in dogs lying around, but as in dogs telling lies.
Again, with the poem Liar Lay, and this was written a few years back, what was happening at the time was the very big debate about don't ask, don't tell. And so that was in the air as I was penning this poem. And the other thing that was in the air was that, and is always in the air, is that I can never tell the difference between how to use lie or lay in a sentence. And I'm a professor and I should know, but I don't. So this poem, Lie or Lay, the strategy was accept advice, which is a nice one, accept advice, which is kind of what you do with the oblique strategy. So here we go. Let sleeping dogs lie. Believe the fabricated tale that Sparky and Duchess were on their way home. Their car got a flat. The curfew passed. They're sorry. Dog tired. We'll explain in the morning. Believe the fib, the ruse, the tall tale that covers the fact the sniffing went a bit too far. There was no problem with the car, no chaperone at the dance. Later, at the pound, there was a rumble. The best policy? Don't bark, don't tell. If sleeping dogs would lay, we'd get the lay of the land, or lay preachers on the stump or fireplug, a barky pulpit. Right-wing evangelists speak of hellfire and obedience. The left counters by claiming all of heaven is off-leash. So let sleeping dogs lie, embellish, let them gild or yellow the lily. My bonny dog lies, not lays, over the ocean. Either way, it's a wide, wide sea, and if truth be told, we're all in it very, very deep. That's for Gizmo.
Well, I'm sure my Chihuahua Gizmo would never tell a lie. I've heard it said that all poetry is political. Did you know that when you were writing the poems for the Takeaway Bin that so many of them would turn out to be political poems?
Well, you know, I have a big political past, and it's funny. I've written very political poems and prose pieces, and that wasn't my intention with this book. But again, that's what was in the drawer. That was in the takeaway bin. Just it's you know you can't remove that.
You're the author of three other collections of poetry, which I mentioned at the beginning of the show. One. Being called My Oblique Strategies, which was a chapbook. Did the poems in the takeaway bin arrive from that chapbook?
You know, how this book came to be was that I had written a starting series of poems that I handed into a chapbook contest, the Frank O'Hara chapbook contest, and that chapbook won the Frank O'Hara Chapbook Award. And I just continued over the years to use the strategies when I would be at my desk or at a writer's residency or with a project, I would continue to use them. So that happened concurrently with other writing projects that were kind of radically different than the Takeaway Bin. My most recent book before the Takeaway Bin was Pink Harvest, which is a collection of nonfiction tales and stories about going to Croatia and living with my partner for many years, and stories about healthcare, lots and lots of different types of essays. And so those, I would write the prose pieces, and when my mind would need a break or I'd need a greater, freer poetic range of motion, I would pick a strategy and work on more poems for the Takeaway Bin. So that's how it came to be. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go back to hearing some of the poems. Why don't you start out with Bus Ride and just go on from there, whatever you'd like to read.
This poem, The Bus Ride, it started with the strategy Infinitesimal Gradations. And it's a poem that really is about not only an internal journey, but an external journey, the start of a day, from the start of the day to the finale. Infinite the possibilities at the start of each day. You can wash the car, write the novel, reach Satori if you make the 4:30 bus. Is it simply a matter of will? The bus, loaded with like souls, approaches the hill, huffs and puffs up the regrade. To your left, the sun is sinking into the sea. Only in subtle gradations of sunset do we see the green flash. The green light says go. The bus continues. You hear the person sitting next to you say, that sideswipe son of mine, he'll never make the grade. The bus shudders. Will we? We're fragile as eggs in a carton, some hard-boiled, some a little cracked, grade A or double, caged or range-free. We're so thin-shelled the slightest comment sends us reeling. We hash it over and over, small potatoes compared to what Viktor Frankl endured, then wrote about in The Will to Meaning. He survived the tortures of the Black Forest, a triumph of will. You can bet when Leni Riefenstahl scaled the Dolomite, she never took the bus, which now passes through the Arc de Triomphe, and there, in the disabled seat up front, a woman who looks like Ingrid Bergman, taking a sip from a cup of coffee as if it's a sweet sip of Calvados. Where would you rather be than here? This morning, this effort, the infinitesimal gradations of thought that are, yes, finite, for here we are at the end of the line. We've made it to the top of the hill, the bottom of the page. There's two other poems that I'd like to read. The poem, The Human Flaw, is a poem about ethics, and there other than the wordplay and a lot of language play and the twisting and turning of cliches in this book, there is a deeper through line about how you treat people and how they treat you. With The Human Flaw, the thing I ask people to consider is if the cashier gave you back money from the till, extra money, more than you deserved, would you give it back to them? And then I ask, if it's Target or Home Depot, would you give it back? So, and usually there's a little bit of a different response. So this poem is called Human Flaw, and it's one of my favorite strategies. Humanize something free of error. Is it the human flow or the tragic flaw? Either way, it's a blemish on an otherwise white placket. Every minuscule spot is noticeable and brings to mind not one, not two, but all of our imperfections, our double trouble duplicities, our less than pleasant lack of pleasantries. The sad fact is we're sometimes liars, sometimes cheats. Oh, heavenly day, let's admit it. To be human is to have more flaws than a bird dog has flus, so let's elevate our errors, not banish them. The time you pocketed the extra change from the checker, knowing full well at the end of the night her till would be short? Did you picture her adding up the day's receipts again and again and still not step up and return that extra fiver? Or the time you heard the cry for help on the phone machine, someone needing a ride, an ear to bend, a favor, then lied, said you'd never received the call. Admit it. You don't always think the best of your fellow man. You don't always assume the best of intentions. When the man sneered, "Go get married," as my lover and I strolled queerly by, was it kind to fire back small minds, small dicks? Tragic error, especially when he and his buddy, the fellow riding shotgun with a shotgun, tailed us home. Go ahead, humanize him, his finger on the trigger, and the cashier who lied about the total, and you with the fiver in your pocket, the epithet echoing. Try to make a getaway. One of my favorite memories was going to a concert by Dick Gregory, the comedian, and he would have us laughing, and then in the middle of our laughter, he would absolutely go for the jugular with a political point that everyone got because they were opened up from the humor. And I think the one other poem I'd like to read is called Persist. I think one thing that I tell the young writers I work with at San Francisco State is that it's a long road, and that that the one thing that one can continue to do is persist in writing and to carry on. And the strategy for this poem, Persist, is just carry on. Even though it would be nice, wouldn't it, to go buck naked into the world, shed snake skin, second skin, but never second sight. It's still unfathomable, isn't it? The degree we need to let go of the past, to dress down. There are veils and shadow puppets in the firelight glow, someone's hands all over the strings, ghosts who manipulate. Darling, will you steer? And a story, classic, long overdue, is projected on the screen. Good and evil spring from the same source. A heart of gold is tarnished. Someone gets their comeuppance. Life treads on. The past is clearly no longer of use. Last year's model, the old prosthesis, the circle pin. Yet what is no longer serviceable still persists, like a cough or a mangle. We need some days to make things thin. Let's then for a moment let the old wall heater kick in and warm our backsides with this spanked heat. The title poem of the book is The Takeaway Bin, and it's the final poem in the book as well. And it includes a dream, and I've always been hesitant to include any dream in any poem, because I feel that people's eyes will glaze over quickly, but this was such a lovely dream and such a rare one. So the strategy for the takeaway bin is take away the elements in order of apparent non-importance. Toss out any crummy little axe to grind. The wood's chopped. You have enough for the long, cold winter ahead. Take away what you plan to do today. Trim your nails, build a seesaw, sweep the ocean floor. It's less important to get the worm than to have one last frame of the dream. You were climbing a mountain. At the summit was a cafe called Happiness. Inside, in a glowing golden room, people were, yes, happy, quietly sipping their cups of tea. It wasn't important who did what to whom. Yesterday's knife in the back. The blade wasn't sharp, your wit less so. Before she takes your order, the waitress points out the daily specials on the blackboard, then tells you to leave what you don't need by the door, in the takeaway bin. Your worries, fears, the go-go boots that never fit, the knitted scarves received as gifts, veils over your eyes, she says. Take away the elements of your unhappiness, then the elements themselves, five, when we last counted, or was it four? Fire, water, earth, oh, air it out. She hands you a cup of tea. Now you're ready, she says. Get out of bed. The day lies before you, clean as a slate. It's yours to write on.
Well, Tony, it's been a lot of fun listening to you read from your book and explaining some things. What's your next project?
The next project I'm working on will probably be a combination of poetry and prose, and it has to do with the iconic Pacifica Pier in Pacifica, California. And what I've been doing is I walk by the pier every morning, and I've come to know particular characters there, and now walk onto the pier often, and the intersection of the different communities, the fishermen and the families who go there on the weekend to walk around, and the surf people, and some people who just hang out there. It's that intersection that is really an intriguing place. And so I'm going to be writing a manuscript that has to do with that, that has a concurrent thread in that I'm from a fishing family. And so memory will also intertwine with a kind of lyric documentary of what's happening on the pier. And it should be fun.
Well, thanks again for coming up, and maybe you'll come back someday and read for the live Word Temple Poetry Series.
I would love to, and you have been absolutely lovely, so thank you so much.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you have been listening to Toni Mirosevich, Mirosevich. She has been reading from her book published this year, The Takeaway Bin. Up next is a little musical interlude, and then we'll go on to John Oliveras Espinosa. This is Otis Spann singing Trouble in Mind.
Trouble in mind, I'm a blue, but I won't be blue. All the sun gonna shine in my back door someday. I'm gonna lay my head on some lonesome railroad. I'm let it 219, ease my trouble in mind. While I'm gone away, Lonnie, Lonnie, I won't be back no more. You know I'm gonna let the wind change. Blow my blue.
is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Up next, John Olivares Espinosa reads from his collection, The Date Fruit Elegies. This book is the inaugural publication of Bilingual Press's new poetry series, Canto Cosas, and was nominated for a Northern California Book Award in 2009. These are not poems about what you might call typical Southern California life, the more visible life of cell phones, swimming pools, everyone lined up at Starbucks dressed fashionably in black despite the 90-degree heat, waiters and waitresses hoping to be discovered. Instead, these are poems that chronicle a Chicano-American family's hard-grind experience in Coachella Valley, a mother and son recycling cans for enough change to buy a meal, for instance. Coins actually form a thread throughout this book. California redemption, contemporary American hunger, economics at GEMCO, aching knees in Palm Springs, and others remind us that the California dream is a dream indeed when it comes to class division. And so necessarily, home is also a theme that runs throughout the book. Espinosa has studied creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, and at Arizona State University. Right now, he teaches writing, literature, and is a retention specialist at the National Hispanic University in San Jose, California. I've asked Espinosa to read some selections from his book, The Date Fruit Elegies.
For this first poem, Achy Knees in Palm Springs, my brother and I used to work with my father as landscapers. And this poem was written on one winter break when I was a junior in college. And we went to go help my dad during Christmas break. And I was very, very kind of upset that I had to do this because I was already 3 years into college. So this is Achy Knees and Palm Springs. One gray Thursday during winter break, Albert and I plucked patches of grass from petunia beds wide as swimming pools within a condo complex. One-story stucco blocks for old men who wipe sweat with dollar bills. We spent our school vacations in shivers, raking, trimming, and mowing frosted yards with Dad. At the eighth hour of kneeling, the weight on my knees was too much for me. For each fistful of grass, I stood up to stretch and let the cold air sneak under my shirt. When Dad noticed the weeds slowly filling the can, he turned to me red-faced and said, "You're packing down the dirt. Kneel on the lawn and weed the beds from there." I said, "I am at least entitled to some circulation." I kept the truth from slipping past my chapped lips, how I didn't care about dirt and weeds from a bourgeoisie's garden. These few men I learned about in sociology class, who raked in more $100 bills than I did citrus leaves in a day. I wanted to tell Dad that these men didn't care if Mexicans spent 10 hours, or even a lifetime, weeding out the same bed the following week. To only tell him about the hours I felt wasted when we could have rested our sore backs on a bed and drowned in a lake of a much-deserved sleep, or sailed through Tierra del Fuego, us standing on the deck and never bowing, not even to the sun. Or how he could have learned to read, and I would finally show him a poem I wrote. But I didn't, because I knew what he would say. "It's the only way to put you through school, this oily sweat." I kept my tongue hidden behind my teeth and watched my brother, hunched over, tossing weeds and years inside a green plastic can, without a word. So originally, I grew up, I was born and raised in Indio, California, which is in the Coachella Valley, about 20 or so miles from Palm Springs. But before that, my family actually lived in Mecca, California, which was about 30 minutes away from Indio. So when in 1986, when I was 8 years old, my family and I moved to Indio, which was like moving to the big city. And when we moved there, my mother took a leave of absence from the school. And so we were, you know, one less income. So this is Contemporary American Hunger, and it's sort of about our special treat, the most special treat we could get living in India, which was going to McDonald's. Contemporary American Hunger. Mom, having quit her job at school to give her neck a rest, tense from hovering like a desk lamp over the special ed kids, had made us the newly broke Mexicans to settle in the India of 1986. Albert and I, barely hip high to our mother, unaware of our budget, salivated as we thought about the dry buns, the grade B patties of Argentine beef at McDonald's for what our TV eyes believe was the best lunch in town. To pay for two cheeseburgers, Mom pulled out her blue purse, laid out $1.38, two dole quarters, 6 dimes, 5 nickels, and 3 Denny's parking lot pennies, found the day before. The cashier's forefinger counted the change as Mom held up the line, waiting red-faced for these burgers to slide toward her on a bright plastic tray. Bun by bread bun, Mom, with a plastic knife, bulldozed the ketchup, mustard, chopped onion, spread before slicing the burgers to give each of her sons a half. Satisfied, we went ahead and ventured through a rainbow of tubes and hollow balls with the blonde heads whose stomachs were full of Big Macs and Happy Meals. But we were happy too, better than staying at home on a Saturday eating rows of potato tacos after our yard chores. Did Mom sit there and watch us play? I only remember her fingers neatly wrapping the remaining half in greasy red and yellow paper, then tucking the lump away in her purse, sustenance for later. My father, as a gardener, would bring home many pots of flowers and trees and shrubs, and with the idea that he would use them later or sell them later, but hardly ever they got sold. And when we did try to move those pots, because we did sell them, we'd find out that the roots would actually break through the pots and anchor themselves where they were. So this poem is called Watering the Black Pots in the Fall. The pots are endless, unorganized row after row, black pots, little pots, fat ones, small ones, dirty, scuffed, cracked. I have to water them all, even the empty ones. The pots hold infant trees, bug-eaten shrubs, violets, petunias, begonias, and flowers I don't recognize at all. My father can tell me their names, but he speaks, these days, it seems, only to the wind. Hidden under his straw hat, his upper lip covered by a Zapata mustache, he has me out here watering in the bitter desert evenings because I forgot to do it earlier before he came back from work. How else are you going to learn some responsibility? He says. My backyard is a minimum security prison with 7 feet of concrete wall, a ward of black tubs of plastic bother. There are more pots under the grapefruit tree. I slip in the mud or bump my head on a branch. I step on the rotten fruit, ruin my new shoes. The hose leaks as I stand there, dreaming about Anna Estupiñan, her eyes that never find mine staring from the back of class. The cold water mixes with a thick desert breeze, giving me shivers for the rest of the night. The chore takes 40 minutes, but I make it 20. And soon enough, the next semester will come with David Martinez pounding Terrence Crawford because his face is black, 6 gangsters from Penn West kicking Jose Chavera in the ribs because he is from the north side, all before completing my freshman year. How I want to move out and never be told what chores to do, never have to duck another punch, never have to hear the slow hum of water escaping the hose as I water the last pot next to the cherub statue, droplets trickling down his legs. So while attending high school, I took a Spanish class with a teacher who was the same teacher my older brother had taken. And he revered my brother very much, and the feeling was mutual. I don't think he cared for me so much. He lettered my brother in Spanish, and he gave me a B. We had this, since we shared this Spanish teacher, my brother and I, we always bring him up because he was kind of a funny man. He was very, very tall, over 6 feet tall, had no hair. We knew he was older, but we could never tell how old he was. He was very ambiguous. And every time we'd ask him for his age, he'd always deflect. And what made it more strange was that he had a two-year-old daughter at the time, which to us, we didn't think, back then we didn't think he could be that old and have children, but was probably not as old as he looked. And every Friday he'd show us film strips, and he'd show us James Bond films, Dr. No from Russia with Love, but it was in Spanish. It was dubbed in Spanish, and took me a couple of years to figure out that James Bond was English and not Mexican. So unfortunately he had, I guess, marital problems and struggles over the daughter. When I was in college, I found out that he actually hanged himself and committed suicide, and partly having to do with the marital problems and the struggle for custody over the daughter. So I wrote this poem as a persona poem in his voice. It's called Wife and Child Leave Mr. Walton, Spanish Teacher. I return home from teaching to a front door left ajar. The silence in the house amplifies the heartbeat from our clock hanging on the wall. I find a note on my little girl's bed, lying in the hollow of her body's impression. I do not punch the wall this time, but that doesn't make up for anything. I eat some dates left on the kitchen counter after my wife blended a date shake this morning. I watch a few minutes of Brady Bunch and Telemundo before weeping into my forearms until dusk. I think if I kill myself, I'll sink nonstop to hell. But a freshman Spanish class is hell for a bald, white male, tall as a doorway, pale as a glass of milk. The Mexican students mock my accent, challenge my knowledge of their culture with their quizzes on pop stars and folklore, though they've never watched a Cantinflas film, and he was greater than Charlie Chaplin. My father taught me to tie a noose to anchor our boat on the deck at a small lake in Ohio. I remember his hands, knuckles like ball bearings under his skin, his fingers fly paper yellow from tobacco, thick nails like teeth on his fingertips. No matter his quick temper, we would never have abandoned him. In a Super 8 motel across the desert, she is probably lying next to my wife, my little one confused, biting into the ear of her pillow, reciting an Our Father in Spanish. Before I swing like broken legs on a piñata above the garage floor, I search her drawers for mementos. I find two bobby pins, a busted rubber band, and a severed blonde head of a Barbie doll, which I stick inside my pocket. I search the garage closet for the step stool with uneven legs. Death smells of rags soaked in acetone and dry lawnmower grass. Adios, pinche mundo. I place two dates in my mouth to take with me something sweet. Just to lighten it up a bit, I'm going to read a poem called Love Simple, which is about my first kiss, which took place in a public library, where I think is so very appropriate for a poet. This is Love Simple. Young love was simple, a bowl of alphabet soup simple. Every morning at 7:45, I strode coolly to summer school, hair slicked back as if I were some Valentino from the black and white films. Her name was Spanish for Juliet. I left home early to those tiny braces that lined her smile like books on a shelf. She scented her hair with lemon shampoo, curled the ends into dark ribbons just for me. After lunch, she fed me, bought me a burrito my few dimes couldn't buy, and still let me rub the soft loaf of her inner thigh as our classmates' heads were craned toward Gandhi, a film about a man I refused to believe was willingly thinner than me. My first kiss happened in a public library, somewhere between the shelves of botany and cardiology, though we were sent to research World War II. Me, I lost the war against badly timed involuntary erections. She was an older and experienced woman. By 15, she had French kissed. So I made my first move, a poorly aimed smooch at the corner of her mouth, when she surprised me with something slippery and soft. I pulled away and asked, "Was that your tongue?" "As if it could have been anything else," she said, wiping the smoke of lipstick smeared on my lips. She left me tingling inside my mouth and with a tendency to walk the library all afternoon wearing my open book smile, my face flushed pink from simple love. So this next poem is called Spanglish as Experienced by a Native Speaker, and it was actually inspired by James L. Brooks' film Spanglish, because when I had heard that a film called Spanglish was coming out, I was really excited, thinking, finally, a film for me. And then once I found out Adam Sandler was starring, I knew it was not a film for me. A George Washington quarter was a cuota. Two cuotas bought us una soda from a vending machine. We asked Abuelito for a cuota to play the video game console. "No," he said, "una peseta." "No, una cuota. Una peseta para la máquina." He called the console a machine, like the machine, máquina, that dropped a cuota for every six cans mother put in. La máquina is what father had us puchar across yardas on the weekends. At work, we ate lunch. At school, we ate lunch. At home, we ate both. Keiki was served on birthdays. It was bien gacho to have your birthday skipped again. Skipiar was done to the unsolvable math problems, which was never attempted again. Half our time was spent on homework. The other half was spent watchando TV. Watcha signaled you were about to do something impressive, but foolish, like a bike stunt. Watchale is what you tell your friends when you nearly plow into them with your bike. A bike is a bica. Uncle Jesse pedaled a bica to the grocery store to buy leche y cornflakes. Leche, not tortillas, were heated in the microwave. Un güey is a dude. Uncle Beto called more than two people una bola de güeyes. I secretly listened to the Beastie Boys and Uncle Beto's troca because I could turn it up full blast. Uncle Jesse pedals back from Quemar with two new plaid shirts. Dad's returning home from his trip to the Dompe, where he left last week's garbage. Mother's fixing Spam sandwiches. Abuelito pulls from his pocket a peseta, but hands me a cuota. This next poem, Grass Isn't Mowed on the Weekends, is about my father, and I guess also a tribute to Mexican gardeners. Here in the poem mentions that my father had lost a lot of his work route to people willing to work less than he charged. And as time went on, he would gain a lot of work. But then now we're in a recession where he's also lost a lot more work. So it almost goes full circle. But this is Grass Isn't Mowed on the Weekends. And of course, one of the images here is a gardener mowing the lawn on a Saturday morning. And I remember we used to get complaints from the people we work for about coming too early, and that's kind of the trigger for the poem. Now sort of the same thing happens to me. I'll try to sleep in, and I'll hear the gardeners outside of the apartment mowing. And I'm wondering, why do they have to come so damn early? I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I wrote a poem about that. I should know the answer. Grass isn't mowed on the weekends. What first comes across our minds about the stocky Mexican pushing a mower across the lawn at 7 a.m. on a Saturday as the roar of the cutter wakes us? Let me take a guess. Why do they have to come so damn early? What do we make of his flannel shirt, missing buttons at the cuffs, threadbare at the shoulders, the grass stains around his knees, the dirt like roadmaps to nowhere between the wrinkles of his neck? Let me take a shot. Dirty Mexican. Would his appearance lead us to believe he is a border jumper or wetback who hits the bar top with an empty shot glass for the 12th time then goes home to kick his wife around like falling grapefruit lying on the ground. First, the stocky Mexican isn't mowing the lawn at 7 a.m. on a Saturday. He doesn't work weekends anymore, ever since he lost one-third of his route to laborers willing to work for next to nothing. Second, he knows better than to kneel on the wet grass because, well, the knees of his pants will become grass-stained, and pants don't grow on trees, even here, close to Palm Springs. Instead, after 25 years of the same blue-collar work, two sons out and one going to college rather than jail, and a small but modest savings in case he loses the remaining two-thirds of his work, no matter how small and reluctantly the checks come in the mail, my father, the stocky gardener, believes he firmly holds his life in both his hands like pruning shears, chopping branches and blossoms, never looking downward as they fall to his feet in pieces like the American dream. This last poem, No Matter How Bad, is sort of, or almost is, the book into the book, because the Date Fruit Elegies primarily was composed of memories of my growing up, my coming of age in India and slightly beyond. And this poem encompasses my very first memory that I have, which was going to the hospital after an accident that sliced my forefoot, the front of my foot. And it ends with me being older, almost close to retirement. The thing about this poem is that I imagine what I would be doing as I'm older. And I also imagine my parents, of which my mom has been widowed by my father, who had died of cancer, which is completely fictionalized. You know, sometimes after readings, I get sympathies and condolences from readers or listeners about my father, and I have to kind of, you know, reveal, like, well, he's not dead. It's fictional, and sometimes I wonder if that, you know, kills the poem for that person. Disappointed that my father is not dead or something, but he is alive and well. So this is No Matter How Bad. A Saturday of violet clouds outside. In my fists, two red and blue plastic pegs. I throw them at the sun with the force of a small sigh, arrogant to think I can stop this spot of fire in the sky. The sun that seems to pick on only my family. Or that I can calm this comet threatening the world's tranquility and Saturday morning cartoons. The pegs, light as dried bones, fall back to earth repelled by the sun's rays. I do no more than knock a fig off our tree, and a crow begins to pick at its fleshy insides. I head inside, defeated by solar blindness. I trip over a garden hoe left out of place, and it slices me between the ankles. I run, cry to a mother squatting over the toilet. Then I'm lying in the back seat of our Buick, the back windshield webbed with water stains. The sun never loses sight of me, nor forgives my betrayal, torching me with all its hatred. At 14, I hoe dried weeds from a thirsty earth, and curse my father for making me do it. The sun curses him also. After 35 years of gardening, he dies of skin cancer, a dark mold across his face. At his wake, I tried reading an elegy, but can't get past the first stanza, because the wash of grief stings me like an eyelash caught in my eye. I try reading it to mother years later, but don't have the lungs for it anymore. She has gone hard of hearing after all the yelling from her father and then her husband. I can do no more than fold it in eighths and slip it into a robe's pocket. Let it all be forgotten with the wash. Turning 50 now with rheumatism, each evening I come home with shoulders slumped and weary from mowing lawns. Despite the searing in my knuckles, despite the cave-dark air of my apartment, I write a few lines, no matter how bad or uninspired. It is then that I go back to eat that fig fallen among the gravel and taste the moment under what I didn't know were the embracing arms of light.
And that was John Olivares Espinosa reading from The Date Fruit Elegies. Before going tonight, I have several announcements to make, and you might want to grab a pen and piece of paper, because I'm going to have phone numbers and dates like mad here for you. First of all, on September 18th, from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m., is the Petaluma Poetry Walk in and around downtown Petaluma. For more information, you can contact Jerry DiGiorno at 763-4271. She has a lot of really fine people lined up that day. Next, on Saturday, September 24th, the Sonoma County Book Festival is back at Courthouse Square, in and around Courthouse Square in downtown Santa Rosa. That begins at 10 a.m. Next, the California Poets in the Schools are facing a tough time right now, and they have a fundraiser planned for October 1st, Saturday, October 1st. If you would like a sailboat trip to Angel Island and a picnic lunch, you can help raise money for the Sonoma County branch of California Poets in the Schools. It takes place on Saturday, October 1st, leaving Sausalito at 10 a.m., returning by 4 p.m. For more information, you can call Phyllis Meshulam, 829-0787 or 486-7450. That's Phyllis at 829-0787 or 486-7450. Get out on the bay and support a really great cause. Our kids really would like California Poets in the Schools to keep going. Finally, on Saturday, October 8th, the Word Temple Poetry Series at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts returns with two wonderful poets, Matthew Zapruder, Z-A-P-R-U-D-E-R, yes indeed, the grandson of the famous Jeb Zapruder, will be reading from his third collection of poetry, Come On All You Ghosts. This was a finalist for a Northern California Book Award, and it is a great book. Joining Zapruder is Alicia Valls. She is a very gifted young American poet with an unusual international sensibility. That is Saturday, October 8th at 7 p.m., the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. Thanks, as always, for listening. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's program, contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Tonight we're going to go out with a short piece sung by Salvatore Licitra, the late tenor who is known as the next Luciano Pavarotti. He died on September 5th of this year. Salvatore Licitra.